Morning.
Would the marshal please call the calendar?
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Riley, Judge Reyes, Honor Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
First case,
go ahead.
Oh, continue. I'm sorry.
Sure. First case, A21-1601, State of Minnesota respondent versus Jude Thomas Mary O'Neill appellant.
Thank you. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're hearing our cases in the Zoom format again this morning. I don't know if either of you has appeared with us on Zoom. The rules are the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for primary argument. Appellant counsel will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal time. There is a timekeeping mechanism up in the left-hand corner of the screen. Please be mindful of the time on the clock. And also attempts by judges to interrupt you with questions. Also, we ask that you state your name before beginning each leg of your argument. We are doing an oral recording, which will be available to the public, so we want to make sure everyone knows who is speaking for the record. With that, we will hear from counsel for appellant in State v. O'Neill.
Good morning. My name is Travis Kyle, K-E-I-L, and I represent the appellant Jude O'Neill. This is a case where the district court erred when finding Mr. O'Neill competent to stand trial. The judge's decision, which is encompassed in her order, erroneously concludes that Mr. O'Neill is competent to proceed in large part due to jail phone calls, that Mr. O'Neill can rationally consult with counsel. The court never addresses in its order that he can participate in his defense. The rules require in a Rule 20 case is that legal understanding is not the sole factor in determining whether someone is competent to proceed. It specifically requires that one be able to rationally consult with their attorney, be able to participate in their defense and understanding the proceedings. The case, like Mr. O'Neill's, this is a case where a person may know who the players in the criminal justice system are, such as a judge, prosecutor, defense attorney, and their role. However, that does not mean that that person can rationally consult with counsel and participate in their defense. That includes being able to sit through the trial and assist their lawyer while the trial is going on. Here, the evidence overwhelmingly says that Mr. O'Neill is not competent to proceed. Dr. Federici, who is a trained neuropsychologist, concludes that Mr. O'Neill essentially cannot retain any information, new information. Dr. Federici and Dr. Reitman, like the other state examiners, conclude that Mr. O'Neill does understand the players in the system, but that's due to what we call his rote learning, which means that Mr. O'Neill has been through the system so many times that he has a general understanding. However, as Dr. Federici and Dr. Reitman indicate and testify to, when you poke harder, Mr. O'Neill has no higher level cognitive understanding. Essentially, he's swimming in a sea of inadequacy because he just doesn't understand.
It seems the district court made some what I would call credibility determinations. And it seems with regard to Dr. Federici that she discounted his opinions because he wasn't a forensic psychologist. And he also gave no opinion with regard to your client's legal competency. And well, we defer to credibility determinations by the district court. We're not fact finders.
Credibility, the judge's order that Dr. Federici is not credible, I mean, that's erroneous. I mean, ultimately, the district court is the one that determines whether or not someone's competent. Someone does, as the court indicates in their order, the court can look at in determining someone's competency. It's not just solely a forensic examiner's report. Essentially, Dr. Federici answers all the questions that a forensic examiner would need to opine, such as, does this person understand? And when you poke through Dr. Federici's report and his testimony, he's saying Mr. O'Neill just doesn't get it. He understands those players, but beyond that, there's just nothing there. He's essentially a first grader in terms of his overall cognitive abilities. He can recite.
Counsel, you started out appropriately with the standard, the legal standard, but to Judge Riley's point, which I think is a good one, that the district court didn't find Dr. Federici's testimony credible because it didn't provide a legal opinion. It didn't fit or address the legal standard, is maybe a better way of saying it. But that was, I don't know how that makes that clearly erroneous. It seems to the contrary. But taking a step back, the district court looked at all the testimony and from the experts. And we generally deferred to the district court's weighing of expert testimony. I mean, really, isn't this ultimately sufficiency of the evidence argument that you're making here? Because you're arguing the district court should have believed all the testimony from appellant's experts and disregarded the court-appointed testimony. Isn't that really what you're asking us to do?
No, I'm saying is the district court was erred when it said that essentially Dr. Federici provided nothing in terms of the overall opinion.
Well, I don't think the district court said that Dr. Federici didn't provide anything. It just didn't give, you know, a lot of weight to it. And giving weight determinations of how much weight to give expert testimony, that's up to the district court to decide.
To a certain extent, but if they're wrong in making that determination, you have a trained expert here. And the court relies a lot in their order on these jail calls for Mr. O'Neill.
Well, the court relies on the court-appointed experts. There are two court-appointed experts that opine that said he does meet the legal definition of competency.
Yes, and the one examiner actually said, Dr. Mills testified that this is a close call here. I mean, Mr. O'Neill is not the most competent person. And then when the court issued their order, they really focused on these jail calls to his grandmother, when in fact, and even the court cites in its order, Mr. O'Neill was talking about a departure. And during the testimony in the competency hearing, there was Dr. McCormick, you know, essentially agreed, like, they didn't question whether departure was actually even appropriate in his case. They just concluded because he talked about it, therefore he knew it. And in fact, in Mr. O'Neill's case, the departure wasn't relevant because it wasn't a presumptive commit to prison. This wasn't a case where the state filed a notice of an aggravated sentence. It was a presumptive state sentence. And so they're relying on these phone calls, which the court does because it cites it extensively in their order. And there was no pushback or anything indicating that Mr. O'Neill even understood what he was talking about.
I'm not sure if that's a fair characterization of what the district court said, because the district court credited the court-appointed testimony of the two doctors because it said they provided a more comprehensive review. They looked at more information. They evaluated him and actually talked to appellant for 6 hours. They administered the structured inventory of Malingered symptomology test, a SIMS test. So whereas the appellant's two examiners, neither one of, in addition to the recordings, and the other two examiners didn't do nearly as extensive an examination as the court appointed ones.
Yeah, and Dr. Reitman testified that the SIMS wasn't even appropriate for Mr. O'Neill. And in
but
fact,
the problem with Dr. Reitman from the district court's vantage point was that he didn't opine about your client's competency at the time of the offense. He last interviewed your client in 2018, and he relied on Dr. Federici's evaluation. Those were her findings with regard to Dr. Reitman.
Well, and the fact of Dr. Reitman saying he last interviewed him in 2018 was incorrect. I believe he testified that he actually interviewed him prior to the hearing because he had drafted a updated competency evaluation. And, you know, any forensic examiner, even the state's, included analysis of all the evaluations. And in fact, the state's examiners did not have, when they interviewed appellant, they did not have Dr. Federici's most recent neuropsychological evaluation. They were going off of evaluations done in, I believe, 2015 and 2016. And in fact, I think Dr. Mills had testified that his opinion could have changed reviewing Dr. Federici's most recent report. So this is a case where I think the court just got it wrong. I think the evidence is overwhelming that Mr. O'Neill is not competent, because they don't, the court doesn't even address that Mr. O'Neill can participate in his defense. It's not just, again, as I mentioned, understanding and being able to just recite. Mr. O'Neill, someone who's got FASD, one of the highlights of that problem is expressive versus receptive, where they'll express themselves like they know what they're talking about, but under, at the end of the day, they're not receiving and processing and understanding it. A trial is a fast-moving process. It's not just, hey, here's a printout of all the questions that are going to be asked with the answers. You know, a defendant is required to sit there at trial, take notes, assist their counsel. It's not just saying, hey, Mr. Examiner, I know that my defense attorney is representing me. The prosecutor is trying to put me in jail. I understand a plea agreement. The cause and effect is huge. And if someone's going to take the stand and be subject to rigorous cross-examination by the state, Mr. O'Neill just can't do it. He's just, as the examiner has mentioned, he can't process, retain new information. He will be lost. And Dr. Federici opines to that, although he's not a forensic psychologist making a legal determination. He testified that Mr. O'Neill would be lost at a trial. He'd be unable to retain, understand, and move with the speed of a trial. And in fact, the state's examiners even mentioned, and even in the past examinations that were reviewed by all the examiners, is that there would have to be several breaks solely because of Mr. O'Neill's inability to follow at a fast pace. And I, just looking at this order, the court got it wrong when it was addressing this. Mr. O'Neill is essentially, again, as I mentioned, a first grader. And that's one of the reasons in the juvenile court, we have juvenile court, is because individuals are still developing. However, Mr. O'Neill stopped developing and is, in fact, deteriorating based upon their reports. And essentially, you go into any kind of classroom to a first grade and say, hey, here's what a judge and jury do. You can teach them. But to expect that they're going to sit through a trial and be able to assist counsel, that's Mr. O'Neill. The problem is Mr. O'Neill can't learn. He may have some rote learning understandings, but he just cannot process and sit through at the speed at which a trial would go. You can't take a break every 2 minutes and continually educate him and hope that he's going to get it. And also the court discounted, you know, all the evidence that was supported of the examiner, such as Mr. O'Neill's mother, who was a lifelong, lived with him almost his entire life, indicated Mr. O'Neill just doesn't get it. He doesn't understand cause and effect. When pressures get up, he panics and he wants to run. And that's exhibited in, you know, Dr. Reitman's testimony, Dr. Federici, because Dr. Reitman had previously interviewed Mr. O'Neill's counselor for inpatient treatment, and they had to give him a one-on-one counselor. And the counselor said, he doesn't get it. He doesn't understand triggers. When things get up, he wants to run. We got to try to calm him down. We got to make sure he doesn't run. And, you know, as appellant's mother had testified, that's what happens with Mr. O'Neill on the outside. When things get stressful, he panics and runs. And just, he is swimming in a sea of inadequacy, does not understand the process and cannot sit through a trial and assist his counsel and participate in his defense. Again, the examiners, all the examiners acknowledge that he understands the roles and can recite that information of what everyone does. But the court does not go through and weigh that evidence that he can participate in his defense and actually sit through that trial with his counsel. I think that's absolutely critical. And the court's reasoning is, in my opinion, clearly erroneous. And the court should remand this back to the district court. Because Mr. O'Neill has really been struggling. He's got a documented history of neuropsych issues. These jail calls just are focused one-sided. There's no one questioning or pushing back on Mr. O'Neill to clarify, how does this really affect your case? Is this really accurate? The court just listens to him and it concludes that they're 100% factual, when in fact, the court acknowledges, or is correct is that there was no departure argument for Mr. O'Neill. He was convicted on a stipulated fact trial, and there was no departure motion filed or argued because it was not a presumptive commit. So there was, therefore, is no dispositional departure. There is no durational departure. So looking at those jail calls, it doesn't give any credibility to the court's analysis and order. And we would ask the court to remand this back to the district court and for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We're now ready for arguments for counsel for the state. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your argument.
May I please the court? My name is George Kennedy. I'm an assistant Sherman County attorney, and I appear on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. The district court in this case followed this court's guidance from State v. O'Neill, the 2020 case. It received evidence about Mr. O'Neill's competency, evaluated that evidence, and decided how to weigh the evidence in its competency determination. It showed the district court showed its mental process and how it decided to assign weight to the evidence. That decision receives broad deference, and then the facts that the court found are adequate to support its competency decision. Because of that, this court should affirm, and I welcome the court's questions.
I think Mr. Kyle raises some really important issues that courts and the general public, maybe not general public, but public are becoming more familiar with, and that is people whose mothers drank alcohol when they were pregnant have these developmental delays and really judgment issues that follow them the rest of their lives. And what should we do with that in the criminal setting? And he argues that his client really should be treated as a first grader because that's where his emotional intelligence and his ways of learning are stuck. And so how do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, first, starting with the competency standard alone, it's not sufficient to have a mental illness or a cognitive impairment. You also have to be able to rationally consult with counsel or understand the proceedings or participate in the defense. And here we have evidence that Mr. O'Neill, despite the cognitive impairment that he has, can consult with counsel, understand proceedings, and participate in his defense. Additionally, the evidence that Mr. Kyle is pointing to about that.
But Mr. Kyle would say that's all just rote learning and nothing that his client has really digested and could articulate on his own, if I'm understanding his argument.
That's my understanding as well, Your Honor. But going back to the evaluations that we have here, Mr. Kyle is relying on evaluations that did not test whether Mr. O'Neill was feigning or pretending to be more severely impaired than he actually is, even though Dr. Federici in 2009 noted concerns about feigning. He never followed up on that in his later evaluations, and only the court-appointed examiners did any sort of testing for feigning of incompetence. So I don't know how much weight should be given to the testimony that he acts at a first grade level, considering that evidence of feigning, and also looking at the evidence from the jail calls where Mr. O'Neill is talking about reading 400-page books, discussing passages of the Bible with his grandmother, and clearly seems to be acting at a more developed level than first grade. So I think that all supports the district court's credibility decision and how the district court weighed the evidence here, resulting in the finding that he is competent.
So I want to follow up on that question because, you know, carefully reading over appellant's brief, I mean, you know, he goes into great detail on the the issues with somebody who has FASD. Did the district court clearly err by relying on Dr. McCormick's report? Because it seems like Dr. McCormick only had a basic knowledge of FASD rather than a really detailed and comprehensive understanding of what that means and what it's involved. I mean, is the application of the SIMS test, did that really result in a true evaluation that he was feigning? Or is it just that, and like, for instance, listen to J.L. Hall's calls, was it just rote repetition of what he had heard from other people? I mean, how reliable really is Dr. McCormick's testimony?
And again, Your Honor, those sorts of credibility decisions are a question for the district court, and they deserve broad deference.
They deserve deference, but our standard of review on this issue is actually when we evaluate for a clear error, we independently can review the record to make sure that the district court did indeed give proper weight to the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree on that. And I guess my way of looking at it would be to ask if the district court's decision was arbitrary or capricious. If there's some explanation of the mental process for how they decided to weigh certain testimony over other testimony, then it deserves that broad deference. I agree that this would be a different question if the district court had said, without any explanation, I am adopting the recommendation of the court-appointed examiners, and I am completely discrediting Mr. O'Neill's expert witnesses and the lay testimony that was also provided. But here we have the district court engaging in the testimony from all of the witnesses and making decisions about how to assign credibility and weigh that evidence. And because that mental process is shown, and it isn't just I have to make a decision, so I choose this one, the district court's decision deserves that broad deference.
Any additional questions from the panel? All right, thank you for your arguments, counsel. We'll now hear from appellant's counsel for rebuttal argument, if any.
Yes, thank you. Well, first of all, the district court never addresses whether or not Mr. O'Neill can participate in his defense. And in fact, the order talks about the understanding of the proceedings and rationally consulting with the court, but never addresses participating in his defense and how he can. In terms of the feigning argument, Dr. Federici and Dr. Reitman testified, if they thought Mr. O'Neill was feigning, they would have conducted tests. In fact, Dr. Reitman and Dr. Federici know Mr. O'Neill fairly well. The state, you know, the respondent alludes to 2009 when Dr. Federici felt like Mr. O'Neill could be feigning, but that was a neuropsych evaluation. And in further testing with Mr. O'Neill, had done another evaluation, I believe in 2015 and 2016, and then in 2021, and there were no concerns about feigning. In terms of the argument, again, about Mr. O'Neill indicating on jail calls he's reading 400-page books, reading the Bible. In fact, Dr. Federici mentions that in his report, that Mr. O'Neill relayed to him he's reading the Bible, but it was beyond him. You know, just being able to say I read doesn't mean I understand it. I could read a book on stocks, but I probably wouldn't understand what they're alluding to. I would need to really educate myself on that. So being able to do simple tasks and saying you're doing something, again, this is the crux of the issue with these jail calls that the court is relying on and the state's examiners rely extensively on, is that there's no pushback. There's no information indicating what Mr. O'Neill is saying is true. He could be reciting something he heard in a jail inmate say. And in fact, when you look at the evidence, Mr. O'Neill, again, talks about this departure, and it has zero bearing whatsoever on his case. A departure was never on the table. It was never anything that would be applicable to his case, yet he's talking about it. And the court specifically mentions that in his order that Mr. O'Neill is talking about a departure and how about his attorney asking for a departure. And this just really highlights the issues with the individuals with FASD. Essentially, it's akin to a traumatic brain injury in utero. And that's what Mr. O'Neill has. And none of these examiners from the state, Dr. McCormick, as a training and as the court asked and as she testified to, I have little to little understanding of FASD and how to akin that to a competency evaluation. Most of these examiners are focused on mental health issues when FASD is a disability, not really a mental health issue. And it's important to understand that because the individuals with FASD have a higher likelihood of confabulating, which means is they're just going to respond because they want to appear smarter than what they actually are. And there's no analysis whatsoever on the state's examiners about going into depth on that to make sure Mr. O'Neill actually understands and can participate in his defense and as a result, consult with his attorney. So with that, I would defer to any questions the court may have.
I just have a question about if we were to agree with you and if this were to go back and if the judge were to decide that he's incompetent based on his FASD, then what?
Well, I think this is the big issue. This is the issue hitting the court system because a lot of individuals, the ABA passed a resolution years ago that individuals in the court system need to be trained on FASD because this is really coming through the court system. You know, as an attorney, I do a lot of work with FASD United. A former First Lady, Susan Carlson, started MOFAS in Minnesota. Because
I'm familiar with proof, but my question is, so if he's found incompetent, then does he go to mental health court and does he end up institutionalized or what do you see happening with your client who
that's one of the
impulse control?
Well, the issue, that's one of the issues facing the criminal justice system, because a lot of individuals who are found not competent, there's a gap. Because a lot of the placements in Anoka, St. Peter, the beds are full, and they're really only committing those with serious mental health issues that require intervention, medication. An individual with FASD, you can't pump them through of psychotropic meds, and all of a sudden they're going to be, like if you're schizophrenic or any kind of other mental health, where you can restore competency. There's a gap, and they're either going to sit in custody pending their case or be released. And it's not just individuals with FASD. That's just the nature of the system. There's a huge gap if someone's found not competent as to what happens. And that's a question the legislature needs to figure out in terms of funding and getting things done. But that's just the reality.
Thank you both for your arguments. Case is submitted. You'll have our decision within